Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast with your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper.
Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast. We are focusing on the volunteer state and our nation today with always an interesting person making a positive change in our community. This time, a tribute to Phil Valentine with special guest Steve Gill. But first, for more information about the Mill Creek View podcast, visit us anywhere you get your podcasts and socials at Mill Creek View, Tennessee. While you're there, please subscribe. And welcome to our People in the News episode, where I interview people who are making an impact and are lovers of truth. Today, we are doing a special tribute to the late Phil Valentine and talking with radio star Steve Gill about Phil. Philip Valentine, nationally acclaimed radio talk show host, passed away on August 21st, 2021, at the age of 61 in Nashville, Tennessee. Phil is survived by his wife, Susan Shirley Valentine, his children, Carr, Campbell, and Douglas, his siblings, Steve Valentine, Mark Valentine, Tanja, and Beth Dollar, Stephen, his stepmother, Barbara Valentine, and his beloved in-laws and extended family. The son of the late Congressman Tim Valentine and the late Betsy Carr Valentine, Phil was born on September 9th, 1959 in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. Growing up a few miles away in Nashville, North Carolina, Phil graduated from the Northern Nash High School. After a brief stint at East Carolina University, Phil enrolled in broadcasting school at Carolina School of Broadcasting. Within a year of graduating, Phil landed his first radio job and spent several years in a small market near his hometown before working in Raleigh, North Carolina. In 1985, Phil packed up everything he owned and moved to Nashville, Tennessee on nothing but faith. Within a week, he had secured a part-time job in music radio. After 3 months, it would become a full-time position. From there, Phil began to work his way up the ladder, eventually landing at WLAC-FM. Just 3 years later, he would have one of the highest-rated morning shows in Nashville and was voted by readers of the Tennessean as DJ of the Year. Steve Gill of the Gill Report was listed as part of Business Tennessee Magazine's 100 Most Powerful People in Tennessee, as well as Talker Magazine's 100 Most Important Talk Radio Hosts in America, and was recognized twice as a hero of the taxpayer by Americans for Tax Reform. He has also received several Achievement in Radio awards. Steve, welcome back. How are you today?
Thanks. Good to be with you. And I think the first thing that struck me, it's hard to believe Phil's been gone almost 2 years. It's hard to believe it's been that long.
It really is. And I'm really thankful that you take the time to come on and talk about him. So he was the son of the late Congressman Tim Valentine and Betsy Carr Valentine, born September 9th, 1959 in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. When did you first meet him?
You know, I first met Phil in, it would have been like late 80s, early 90s. I had run for Congress here and then had narrowly lost, and then got a call from a radio station asking if I'd like to come on their morning show. And I said, yeah, what morning? And they said, well, every morning. And you know, my reaction was, well, exactly what time and does it pay anything? And we were able to negotiate the pay. The timing was a little difficult. I was on from 5 to 9 a.m. And I had played basketball during college. And one of our coaches had always said, you got to be ready for game time no matter when it is. And if that's when the game time is, show up ready to play. So I started that in about 94, 95. And that's when I really got to know Phil. We always were on different day parts. I was mornings. He was always afternoons. He came and back to the market after he went to Philadelphia for a while. And we were literally on the same station sometimes, on different stations sometimes. But we were always in different day parts, but always were great friends. We're common in our viewpoints, our constitutional and conservative agenda. And our sons were friends. Our sons went to elementary and middle school and high school together. So we always had that connection as well.
Very nice. Very nice. So he was here and then he went away to Philadelphia and he came back, but you met him in his first stint as well. What were your first impressions of him?
You know, because he was on at a different time, I actually got to listen to him. You know, if you're on at the same time as somebody, you never hear them. And I was not somebody who really liked to listen to other talk radio hosts because I didn't want to find myself either copying them or saying the same thing. So, you know, you really don't listen to them that often. But, you know, I'd catch Phil, particularly on Fridays when he would have his special Who's in the Booth Dancing on the Pole kind of segment. And they would have different celebrities that they would pretend were spinning around the pole, dancing on the stripper pole. And that was just one of the kinds of Phil Valentine could paint a visual picture that I think still remains in folks' eyes today. But you know, it's funny. I had a lady one time tell me that you know, look, you just say the same thing Rush Limbaugh says, you know. And I said, well, you know, maybe. I said, but I say it 3 hours earlier because I was on a morning person at midday. So it's amazing how people think you're just all kind of running from the same script. And I think one of the things that made Phil so good is that he had the cultural knowledge, the political knowledge, obviously, and interest, the historical knowledge. And yeah, unfortunately, you've got a lot of folks in the talk radio business that are kind of one trick ponies. They, you know, they'll take whatever's on Breitbart and that's their story. And they don't have kind of the music background that Phil had that could bring in the cultural connection of, you know, when you're playing a bumper song, that he knew something about the artist that he was playing. So I think that added more fabric to his shows that is one of the reasons he was so successful and so popular.
I think so too. So it was June of 1995. The Phil Valentine Show was born on talk radio when WWTN offered him a position as a morning host, finding an instant audience. Do you remember sort of the buzz around town of this show as it was getting its legs under it?
You know, and my first start was at WLAC AM across town. And it was about that same time. My first day on the air was the day that a tornado came blowing through downtown Nashville. I like to tell people that I created atmospheric dissonance from the very moment I got behind a mic. Because it was on at the same time. Again, initially, we didn't have any real interaction with each other. And then he moved to afternoons. And after a couple of years that I was at WLAC, I moved over to WTN and took the morning slot.
Uh-huh. Okay. So following the show's success, Phil was offered WWDB in Philadelphia. In his first year, he won 3 AIR awards, which are Achievement in Radio, for Best Talk Show, Best New Talent, and Best Morning Show Host or Team, which was actually a first in radio history. Do you remember that? And did you ever pick him up when he was, it's a little different back then. Yeah. You can't pass around MP4 clips or go on iTunes and listen to the show afterwards like I do often with other guests. But did you have any perception of how he was doing in Philadelphia after he left?
Not really. You know, again, when people kind of slip in and out of markets, that you're not kind of keeping up with them as well as you probably could or should. I basically remember more when he came back. It was funny, though. We did broadcast at the I guess it was probably the Democrat convention in Philadelphia, one of the national conventions. And he was going to show me around Philadelphia a little bit. And at one point, we're driving through a part of Philadelphia where we suddenly realized that there were bars on all the windows. Even cop cars seemed to be getting out of that area as quickly as they could. And I'm saying, great, Phil, you've just brought us into the hood where we're going to get killed. I said, why don't we stop, tell one of these guys on the street corner that we've got a lot of cash with us, and we're just trying to figure out where to go spend it. See how that works out for us. So yeah, he was giving me the tour of Philly and he regaled me with a lot of his Philadelphia stories. You know, it's interesting because Philadelphia, like a lot of northern cities, are very segmented with you know, the Irish section, the Polish section, the Black section, the Jewish section. And you know, Phil, being a Southern guy, he moves up to Philadelphia, moves into a nice house. He and his family move in. They don't realize they've just moved into the Jewish section of town, and everybody's like going, okay, who is this Baptist guy that's living in the neighborhood? So Phil was creating atmospheric disturbance both on the air and in the community from the moment he got to Philadelphia. But they fell in love with that Southern guy from North Carolina.
Ah, well, that was a very good tie-in there. You're a pro. So Phil returned home to Nashville in 1998, back at WLAC. He and his longtime friend and producer, Johnny B. Bozeman, worked their way to the top of the Nashville market. Did you ever get to know Johnny B. and any reminiscence of him?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, by this time, I'm over at WTN in the mornings. He's back and he's on WLAC in the afternoons. But we're both going to the, you know, talkers conventions. We're going to different events around the country. You know, we would both find ourselves broadcasting from New Hampshire with the New Hampshire primaries, which is still the Super Bowl of politics. It's not quite as good as it used to be, but you'd go there and there'd be, you know, a diner, and there'd be, you know, presidential candidates from both sides. There'd be rock stars and movie stars that are there schlepping for their candidates. And Phil and I would be at these kind of events all the time and catch each other there as well. And again, by this time, our kids are in school together. So we're getting to know each other through their friendship as well.
And did the Hollywood types and the New York types and the DC types look down on the two kids from Nashville, or were you accepted as talkers?
You know, we were both kind of at the top of the game, and part of it was because we were able to get the top people in politics, the Don Rumsfelds, the Condi Rices, that, you know, both of us had the ability because we had good reputations, we had good credibility, that we actually knew what we were talking about and not just, again, kind of rip and read talk hosts. So, you know, we both had great guest list. And again, when you get close to those presidential primaries, you'd have some of the celebrities, these movie stars and actors that were, again, promoting their candidates, particularly on the left side, that would be calling in. I remember Phil would have, you know, some of the most extreme liberals in the country calling in, particularly when you were getting into primary day here in Tennessee, trying to push their candidates. And I think they were kind of taken aback that they were not in Kansas anymore. This was a different environment than Hollywood in terms of the perspectives of these talk hosts that were interviewing them. And I know I always had fun, and I think Phil had a great time with Rob Reiner, I think, was one of his guests one time. And if it had been possible for them to get into a fist fight over the phone, I think it would have happened.
And isn't that interesting? Because I'm not so sure that post-Phil era, you would get, you know, they stay in their echo chambers. They stay in their far left, far right corners. They don't intermix as much as they did back then. So that's great that he was sort of one of the last crossfire types who would get into it with anyone left, right, or center, because he was had enough wit and wisdom to be able to hold a conversation with both sides of the aisle.
But I'll tell you, some of my favorites were those who were articulate and intelligent on the left. I mean, Richard Dreyfuss, big time liberal. You know, he stayed with me for an hour one time. It was one of the best conversations. And I won't even say it's an interview. It was one of the best conversations I ever had on the radio. And I think Phil had the same experience. You know, there are some that are there just, you know, doing their talking points. They're just there, you know, kind of reciting whatever they've been told to say or whatever their knee-jerk left-wing reaction is. But the good ones were the ones, again, like Richard Dreyfuss and others that would really be engaging and could discuss, I won't even say debate, but could discuss the issues in an informative and informed and engaging way. And I think both Phil and I love that probably as much as anything. You know, sometimes you get one of the celebrities in because they had some book and you're putting them on because it's some movie star. And some of them, you know, were interesting. Some of them, if you got them off their script, there really wasn't anything there. And I know Phil was always kind of like me. I'm like, I think it was Larry, one of the big talk hosts at the national level, would always say, I don't read the books of the people that I interview. And I know Phil and I would have these discussions that if you didn't respect them enough to read their book, why are you putting them on their air? So he and I were kind of different in that we would actually read the books of the people that we were bringing on to discuss their books. Now, to be fair, it was very disarming for these guests all the time because they've written their book. It's been 2 years since they're going on the book tour. And you're saying, okay, in chapter three, you're talking to this, and they're going, I haven't read my book in 2 years. You have an advantage over me. And I know Phil and I would often laugh about the fact that we knew more about their books at the time we were interviewing than they did.
Yeah, and some of them probably read it the first time when they did the audio book because it was ghostwritten, so they didn't even know what was in there. They just
whoever wrote it for them. You know, it's like
that's the person you wanted to have on. Okay, so 5 years later, December 2003, Phil announced he would be moving his show to 99.7 WTN, where he was named by Talker Magazine as one of the top 100 talk show hosts of all time. Was there a hitting of his stride at WTN? Was he carrying forward what he'd already been seated with early on? What changed that made him so, you know, stratospheric in that move?
Well, WLAC was 1510 AM, and it was one of those clear channel stations that had a huge reach at night. But during the day, it didn't have as much reach. So when he moved from WLAC AM to WTN FM, the boom of that FM signal was a lot stronger. And frankly, you know, you had a good lineup. You know, WTN at that point, I'm on in the mornings, he's on in the afternoon. So you had a good lineup that kind of bookended throughout the day. And I think that helps both, because at the end of the day, people are, you know, getting home, they're getting out of their car, they're going inside when they get up in the morning and get in their car, they're still on that station because that's where they were listening that night. So that it kind of helps both ends of the cycle. Now,
that's
in between,
true.
Before he got back to WTN, that's when the great income tax battle happened. When he was at LAC, I was at WTN, and we were coordinating with the horn honkers, as they are now called, to turn out protest against a Republican governor who had campaigned for re-election, Don Sundquist, in opposing a state income tax. The Democrats controlled the legislature at that time. They were trying to force through a state income tax. Don Sundquist had opposed it, and he came into re-election and suddenly proposed a state income tax. And Phil and I and a couple other talk hosts that were in town at that point really kind of led the fight against the state income tax. And I will be the first to admit, Phil and I get way too much credit for stopping the state income tax. The people that turned out by the thousands that would circle the Capitol, honk the horns, and stop it, they deserve the credit. They were providing the action. We were just controlling the volume on the dial.
Well, it takes one or two to start the movement. I mean, we've all seen the, Les Mis, where the one little kid waving the banner brings everybody with him, or else it wouldn't have happened. That same year, 2003, he released his first book, a guide to conservative philosophy called Right from the Heart: The ABCs of Reality in America. Within a few weeks of its release, it hit the top 100 of Amazon's best-selling books back in 2003, 20 years ago. That was a big deal. Did you happen to read that book? And it was obviously part of the tax reform movement.
I think I have a I think I have a signed copy here somewhere behind me.
Oh, that's
Yes.
great.
And he, I'm not sure again the timing, whether he did an inconsistent truth before or after that, exposing Al Gore's
Before.
inconsistencies when it came to global warming. So, Phil was again a multi-platform communicator, not just not just on radio. He was in some movies during that time. He was writing a book or books, and was doing doing the film as well. So, he was a guy that understood, I think, very early in the process, that one-dimensional communication is not the most effective way to make things happen. And I think, again, as I was going to say, that really kind of got us both on the same page during the income tax battles is that I came from a very activist standpoint. I'd been involved in political activism. I'd run campaigns. Phil's dad, being a congressman, he was in that same mindset. So both of us were in that mindset of, you don't just sit in the studio and talk about what's happening. You go and try to affect things. You make things happen. And again, that was part of why we were broadcasting from places like the New Hampshire primaries, the conventions, and other locations. So it just made sense to us as non, him more of a radio guy than me, but him as an activist, not just a radio guy sitting back commenting on what's happening, to actually roll up your sleeves, get out there, and make it happen. And I think that was a big part of the income tax battle, and it was certainly a part of him being involved in different platforms of communicating rather than just kind of being one-dimensional.
That's great. And I have a similar honor as he does. I was branded a conservative activist podcast by the Tennessean, and he was called Conservative Talk Radio for Nashville. How would you define his conservatism, and how would he feel about Lee and McNally and Sexton and Jack Johnson as Republican leadership today?
I think that it's always interesting to me when I appear on, television shows in Nashville and around the world. We always get branded as conservatives, but they'll have somebody sitting next to us taking the Democrat side. They never call them liberals, and they can be the most extremist liberals, but they don't brand them. But they always feel like they've got to brand us. And I would say, Steve, with you, with Phil, with me, they only have to listen to us for about 15 seconds, and they know we're conservative. So I don't know why they have to put the brand on us at the outset. But yeah, I think Phil was one of those that followed the mantra, and I'd go back to how Newt Gingrich described it so often and so well: get off our backs, get out of our pockets, and get out of our way. That kind of conservatism. Don't tell us what to do. Don't tell us how to do it. Give us the opportunity to succeed or to fail, because we've got that opportunity, we've got that freedom, and we've got that right. So stay out of our pockets, get off our backs, and get out of our way, and let us go and succeed. And that's a missing piece of, I think, the conservative message so often today. It's so often Republicans, particularly Republicans in name only, they want the government to step in and do a lot, just not as much as liberals. Well, that's not conservatism. That's kind of watered down liberalism. And I think that what you had with Phil was somebody who not only understood it, but believed it and could communicate it as he did in his books and on the air.
He published a second book, Tax Revolt, simultaneously led the fight against the state income tax in Tennessee with you. The issue reached a fever pitch in 2002 when throngs of protesters, energized by talk radio, honked their car horns outside the Capitol, ultimately stopping the measure in its tracks. And that's before all the construction on Broadway. So it must have been quite a scene.
Yeah, I got to tell you the dirty little secret of the income tax battle. You know, is one morning, you know, again, he's railing about it on the air in the afternoons. I'm railing about it in the mornings, and one of the rock stations at our group, you know, they one of their hosts said, "Hey, can you come in and tell our audience what's going on with that?" And I said, "Sure," and I went in, and man, you talk about getting revved up. If you thought the talk hosts were getting energized about this income tax battle, stopping it, you know, honking horns and stuff. This rock and roll crowd were even going more crazy, and people calling and saying, "Well, we need to go down there and just shoot some people." It's like, "Well, let's not go do that." But after the show was over, I'm talking to the host on the rock station, and he's going, "What else can we do? What else can we do?" And I said, "Well, we're going down in the morning and literally broadcasting in front of the Capitol, so you know, y'all could come down and broadcast too." And the rock station had just gotten a big Humvee, red, black, white, and black camo, the Rock, and I said, "You can bring the vehicle down there and have somebody hold up a sign, honk if you're against the income tax." He goes, "That's a great idea." So by the next morning, we had the rock station, the talk station, the country station. I think we had one of the urban stations that were all lined up to broadcast or at least have a presence down there. And you know, it's all set up, and he comes in while I'm still at the station and goes, "Hey, we're all set up. We're good to go tomorrow." And I'm drinking a cup of coffee before I'm heading out. And he goes, "You know, it's just too bad we're not in Memphis." I said, "Why? Why would we want to be in Memphis?" And he said, "Well, then we could do it at the state capitol." I said, we are at the state capitol." So the next morning, you had people that were circling and honking. It became a traffic jam that people that may not know Nashville that well, from the capitol all the way to the interstate. The interstate was getting blocked. People would literally circle and honk all day. People working in the state offices hated it. But that's how the horn honkers originated. Frankly, thanks to a guy who thought we should have been doing it in Memphis.
Yeah, well, the greatest part of that story is that, you know, coming as a refugee like I am from Washington, or where Steve is sitting right now, and this is the Steve show today, they try that tax implementation every couple years, maybe every 2 years, every 3 years. It's proposed again and again and again. It's never happened in Tennessee again. So your honking was so effective that they have haunted by it to this day, 21 years later.
Well, and they still refer to them as the horn honkers, which really were the Tea Party before the Tea Party was the Tea Party. And a lot of folks that were out there on the steps of the Capitol holding up signs, circling and honking, ended up running for office, becoming state legislators. We ended up passing a constitutional amendment to specifically forbid a state income tax. And the Republicans went from being in the minority at that point to a supermajority in the House. And a lot of that was that impetus of the horn honkers getting into power. That's why I always thought it was odd when people would talk about the Tea Party of, well, you know, we need to form a separate party. No, just take over the one that's there. Just dominate it. And that's exactly what happened in Tennessee.
The platform that already exists, the low tax, low regulation platform. Yeah, just run with that, would you? Okay.
The funny thing. Whole income tax battle, though, is, you know, at that point, I'm on WTN in the mornings, Phil's on WLAC in the afternoon. So we've got them kind of bookended in terms of the legislature. And so they couldn't figure out if they could wait till after I went off the air, maybe they could try something. And then they'd have to worry that when Phil comes on the air, because the station that I'm at by that time, we've got sports in the afternoon, but got Phil on WLAC. So we're pounding them, you know, in the morning and in the evening. And then one day they figured out, we'll do something right after Phil goes off the air, you know, then we'll try to push it through. Well, by that time we had email list and we had the ability to put the word out, and again, drew thousands of people after he went off the air, because they were thinking, oh, we're going to manipulate to the timing of when the hosts are quiet. Nope, that didn't work either. And I think what drove our two stations, you know, you had two big, you know, ownership groups, one with that was only WTN, one that had WLAC. And it would drive the management crazy that Phil and I were talking about, okay, when do we call out the forces? Because you don't want to turn out the crowd to honk and protest if it's not something that's really coming to a head, because then, you know, it might be a smaller crowd. The legislators would say, see, they're losing momentum. So it really took a lot of timing of figuring out, when do you call out the troops? And so Phil and I are coordinating that all the time when people are saying, we need to turn out this Tuesday. It's like, no. You know, and we're talking to each other, we're coordinating that so that we're issuing the call to action at the same time. And again, the station management didn't realize that all boats rise. And if by coordinating it, it not only had a bigger impact, but it also benefited both of us in terms of ratings and impact and everything else. So, you know, the folks that run radio sometimes don't really understand radio.
They're competitors, not collaborators. Absolutely. So Phil was also the winner of the prestigious Golden World Medal for the New York Film Festivals. His screenwriting won the California Film Awards, the Nevada Film Festival, the Colorado Film Festival, and was a finalist in 10 other festivals, including the American Movie Awards and the Beverly Hills Film Festival. I don't know if everyone would know that. And he's also an award-winning movie producer. Were you involved or watching any of that roll out as he was busy doing all the other things he was doing?
Absolutely. And don't you know it drove the Hollywood crowd and the Beverly Hills crowd and all those other leftist festivals nuts to have to give him an award for some film that I'm sure they despised at the very angst of their soul. So again, he was having an impact not just on the air here, but also as he was having the film and even appearing in some films as well. He was having fun and having an impact.
He acted in Atlas Shrugged in 2014, the role of Eugene Lawson, who heads the Community Bank of Madison and gets a job with the government when his bank goes bankrupt due to new government policies. Very ironic.
Yeah, it didn't actually flow into SVIB or SVB, but it a precursor to that. It was great to see the Atlas Shrugged films, that taking that book to film, because I know it had been, decades trying to take Ayn Rand's vision and putting it into film. But I know Phil was particularly thrilled to play a part in that as well.
Yeah, it's clever. And then as well as a number of novels. He had Right from the Heart, The ABCs of Reality in America, The God Players, a legal thriller, Barbican, a Sterling McQueen spy story. And I know how he was very interested in how the spy stories have become very squishy and he liked the manly spies. And The First Face of Janus. And those are all available on Kindle, by the way. Did you read any of them? Have any interest in those?
Yes, and you're exactly right. He liked the shaken, not stirred Bond type spy, not the the woke kind of spies that we take. I think Kiefer Sutherland in 24 would have been more in the model that that Phil would like.
Yeah, not the Born Again maybe, or the Spy Who Loved Me. In 2012, he created the award-winning documentary An Inconsistent Truth.
That's the day. I couldn't date of that one.
Yeah, and that was obviously a counter to Al Gore's, I think it was back in 2000, Inconvenient Truth. So Inconsistent Truth. Was he particularly proud of that?
Oh, absolutely. And the fact is that we've still been proven right, and Phil's rebuttal has been proven right. The icebergs are still there. The polar bears are in bigger numbers than they were when Al Gore was predicting they'd all be gone. And isn't it interesting how many of the Hollywood celebrities are buying beachfront property at the time that they're telling us the ocean's going to rise and the shore's going to move inland? But they're still buying beachfront property. If they really believe their own bogusness, they'd be buying beachfront property in Las Vegas rather than in California. I mean,
Montana, yeah.
always told folks, we're just one really good earthquake on the San Andreas Fault of having California's electoral votes nearly disappear and California being red. So I mean, just one good earthquake and California's politics shifts dramatically.
Unless, of course, it doesn't sink and then you just have two Hawaiis, but that's another story for another day. He
It might.
also, oh.
Hank Johnson was worried about Guam. Remember the congressman down in Georgia that was worried that if we put more military on Guam, it might tip over. I think that'd be the challenge if we have that earthquake and part of California kind of floats ashore. Would it tip over?
I believe his name is Benny Johnson. That's the caliber of politician we have in Congress. Well, we don't. Tennessee's got some good ones. And he would also go on to write accolade screenplays for both movies and television, as well music that garnered international radio play. So this guy's done radio, books, television, documentaries, and now we're talking about music. Did he play his own stuff on the radio?
He was again, he came from the music side. He started off as a music DJ, and I think that's what I was mentioning earlier, that this is a guy that wasn't just a one-trick pony, couldn't just talk about politics or whatever came off the Drudge Report. He could bring a different perspective, brought obviously brought humor, put parody songs into play that he and Johnny Bozeman put together. So again, it was that creativity that set him apart. And I think again, in the in the footsteps of a Rush Limbaugh. You know, people, you know, forget how funny Rush was, how he could talk about sports seamlessly, how he could talk about music and culture seamlessly. And I think that's what sets the great talk host apart, that they're not just, you know, rip and read, you know, what is the Drudge Report saying? What's on, you know, the latest Politico report? You know, it's, there's something more to it. And I think that's what draws people in. It's what creates an audience. It's certainly what creates that younger audience that that you see, you know, a Tucker Carlson or a Greg Gutfeld able to claim, because it's not just kind of stodgy, old, and stiff. And I think, you know, Phil was doing it long before those guys were bringing humor to the forefront of mocking politicians, not just talking about them.
Yeah, and somebody with some wisdom and some interest outside of just the same old politicians or the Republican Party, where you can go anywhere on a riff in a conversation, unlike, say, I hate to disparage him because he's very popular, but like a Sean Hannity, who's kind of repetitive. You know, you kind of can tune in once a month because you probably heard the same thing 5 days in a row. Whereas Phil and you could actually think off the cuff because you have other, you've read a few books, let's just put it that way. And so not only that, but he was also able to roll with the times. So in 2018, he co-hosted a podcast with his son, Campbell, called The Pod Goats. The podcast broke 1 million downloads. God bless him. I wish I could. And received a number of honors. So he didn't just stick in the old radio ways. He was able to come up with a new technology and get involved in podcasting.
Well, and Campbell and Carr were two of his sons who were buddies with my sons. In fact, I think it was Carr that my son Ryan was lifting up on his shoulders at one point to dunk on a basketball goal. Carr fell off and broke his leg. So, but Phil, to his credit, blamed Carr, not Ryan. So again, like I said, the kids also, not only do they keep us young, but man, it gave great fodder of what you're talking about on the air. Because it's, again, just that little bit of a different perspective. And I know that Campbell and he had great fun with the podcast. They did everything from history to music to culture. And it was a different kind of podcast. And again, if you've got the ability to be creative, to be outside the box, you're going to draw ears and eyeballs that just another podcast isn't going to do. And I think doing it with his son was something he was particularly proud of.
Yeah, that's really cool. And so Phil received 17 AIR awards in Nashville, including 5 for best talk show host. He was named by Talker Magazine as one of the top 100 most important talk show hosts of all time. Obviously says quite a lot about him, because do you know about the AIR awards? Is it sort of like the foreign press awards for Hollywood, where your peers vote for you, or is it the press that votes for you, or who voted those awards to him?
Those achievement in radio awards, AIR awards, achievement in radio. And there's different categories that you can submit. You submit your clips, and then they have panels of quote experts who are generally out of the market that listen to the clips and decide what's the winning, you know, best commercial, best on-air talent. And in particular, it's a challenge, you know, for conservatives to win those, because the folks on those panels tend to be folks that are NPR types. They don't like conservatives. So when they're listening to what he or I have to say, there's kind of a bias against you. So the fact that you can win those awards speaks even more highly based upon the panels that are making the decisions of what's the best, based on, again, creativity, talent, the ability to articulate. And it's a particular achievement, no pun intended, to win an AIR award, knowing the kind of people that are making the selections.
Yeah, exactly. Do you think he'd ever find himself in the Radio Hall of Fame post?
He should. And when you look at the breadth of his involvement, both as a music DJ in Philadelphia, in Nashville, on different stations, and when you look at the impact, again, if they give Lifetime Achievement Awards, he should certainly be up for one of those kinds of honors. And you look at impact, and again, not just impact on traffic and weather every 10 minutes on the 10, but the impact of what you say in between, of both impacting the community, educating the community, informing the community. You know, I've often been asked, you know, what makes a great talk host? And I think this is what epitomizes what Phil was able to do. You have to be informative. You have to be credible. You have to be accurate in what you're saying, but it also has to be entertaining. And I often tell people, it's like the best teachers you had. They didn't just impart information. They did it in an engaging and entertaining way. And that's what a talk host has to do. I mean, you got people that'll sit there and almost kind of in an intoning way, just kind of almost read the news in a very boring way. And yeah, that's information. And you've had teachers like that too. The best teachers are the ones that engage you, get you to ask more, to want to know more. And again, I think that's one of the things that made Phil great. He was that best teacher you ever had.
Yeah, that's a good point. But above all, Phil was a devoted father and husband. In a final letter to his wife and children, he wrote, "Please know, of all the things that kept me busy, nothing was more important than my family." You said you knew his kids, your kids knew his kids, you knew his wife. Is that pretty accurate? It was family first?
He adored his family and they adored him. I don't think I ever saw him that I didn't tell him when he was with Susan that he outkicked his coverage, and he never denied it. He recognized that he had far surpassed what he should have been able to achieve with Susan by his side, and his kids were, it's funny. We have our kids and they have pieces of us and they have pieces of their moms and they have pieces that they pick up from their friends. But Phil's kids all had a piece of him that, again, particularly Campbell, had that raconteur. He could tell a story. He could entertain, he could inform. And then some might be a little bit more quiet and were the more introspective author side of Phil. So again, they all have pieces of him. And I think Phil would be the first one to say they all have the best pieces of him and hopefully none of the negatives.
Wow. And so Beth Valentine Dollar wrote, "We are a team and I cannot believe that you are gone." She wrote on Facebook, "I love you so very much." She explained, "You get to see Mama before I do. So please catch her up. Tell Daddy we miss him every day too. Give them both a big hug for me." So obviously very, very close family, even the extended ones. That must have been his sister?
Yes, yeah, his sister. Yeah. And I got to tell you, his brother Mark was, and I think Phil would be the first one to say, and Mark would be the first one to admit, Mark was bona fide crazy. Mark would spit out hurricanes. They called him Hurricane Mark. He'd call in from hurricanes while they were blowing, in wherever location the hurricane was, when he was, I think, in Florida or North Carolina, and he'd be like hunkered down giving live reports of the hurricane. So he became known as Hurricane Mark, and they'd throw the most extravagant parties during the course of a hurricane that had everybody fleeing for shelter. But Hurricane Mark was there and usually calling in live on the air with Phil.
That's amazing. So when you close your eyes and you think of the very first thing, when you think of Phil Valentine, what do you think?
Laughter. I mean, he is a guy that you could hear the smile on his face when he was telling a funny story and the chuckle, the love of what he was doing and what he was sharing. And I think, again, as you know, people think, in radio, particularly without podcast or video, that how you look doesn't matter. But people can hear if you have a smile on your face when you're doing a story, when you're telling a story. And Phil's smile, even though you couldn't see it, was infectious when he was having fun and enjoying what he was doing.
Yeah, that's what radio is all about, is you got to paint those pictures. So he not only did all the things that we talked about, from everything from radio in the early days to podcasted near the end, but he had a blog. And on Monday, January 11th, 2021, he wrote, "The Big Tech Revolt. We are in a revolution. The revolution didn't begin on January 6th with the Capitol riots. Anyone who tells you violence is the solution is dead wrong. The paper patriots who thump their chest and call for some sort of violent overthrow of government are leading you astray. They don't have a plan. There is an anger-driven reaction that goes absolutely nowhere. I get the anger. I'm angry too. There is yet to be a full accounting of what happened in the November election. There was undoubtedly voter fraud. Was it enough to change the actual results of the election? We may never know, but burning your own country to the ground like the left has been doing for the last 8 months is not the answer. The true revolution began on January 8th. It's the big tech revolt. When Twitter permanently banned President Trump from its platform, it finally awakened at least half of the country as to just how powerful and just how dangerous these big tech companies are. What do you think he'd say about Jan Sixers still in prison for misdemeanor trespassing and the Durham report proving it was all a dirty Hillary trick and censorship?"
Somewhere in heaven right now, he and Rush Limbaugh are fighting over the golden mic, saying, "Give me the mic, hit the on button," because there's so much going on that both he and Rush would love to be commenting on, sharing, dissecting whether it's the Durham report, whether it's the $10 million that's gone into the Biden crime family, to the January 6th folks that are still in prison while Hunter Biden is still free. Again, I can just picture he and Rush literally fighting over the microphone of who gets to talk next.
That's awesome. His blog was classic. It was called "I'm Calling Bovine Scatology with Phil Valentine." His last one was, "People keep saying coronavirus is not without precedent, that we shut down the economy in 1918 because of the Spanish flu. Phil Valentine calls bovine scatology on that. There's a lot of justification for tanking the American economy amid the coronavirus pandemic, but those who say we did the same thing during the Spanish flu in 1918, the truth is eye-popping. Phil Valentine calls bovine scatology on that."
Well, and we know more. We still don't know the truth about COVID and the vaccines. And we do know that one of the top executives of one of the big pharmaceutical companies, I think it was in France, is now being prosecuted for faking his injection. Guy that knows this was dangerous, faked it because he knew not to get it in his system. So, again, we're learning more and more. We're now learning that the whole 6-foot rule was ridiculous and just made up out of whole cloth, that masks didn't work. And we remember the mask Nazis. I will say, though, that of all the things that we are going to look back on and just shake our heads at how stupid our culture had become, was the one-way aisles at the grocery stores and the tisks you'd get from little old ladies if you passed the peanut butter and started to walk a couple of steps back to grab the peanut butter, going sort of the wrong way down the aisle. The arrows in the grocery store, that and the people on the airplanes that wanted to be mask Nazis of, I'm sorry, your mask has to be all the way above your nose. And, you know, and I know Phil would have joined me in slowly eating one peanut M&M at a time. So they were constantly eating on the plane. Every time they walked down the aisle, I'm still eating one at a time so that my mask could be down below my nose.
I can picture that. And then 6 months later, he dies, August 21st, 2021. He passed away, they say, from COVID in the hospital. He was obviously very anti-vaccine. The haters were very happy about it to say, see, should have had the vaccine. You remember all that controversy and all that negativity going on while he was suffering from whatever it was that ailed him?
Yeah, and plenty of people have died with the vaccine. Plenty of people have spread the COVID disease with the vaccine. And we're now seeing that people who got the vaccine are now dying post-vaccine. So again, we haven't gotten the truth. We haven't gotten the valid science of what was actually going on. And I think that the trying to portray Phil as some victim of COVID is still, I think, scientifically inaccurate. Look, Phil was a heavy smoker early in his life. There are other health issues that are a factor in the people that passed and those that didn't. And frankly, I work in the healthcare industry. People that went on ventilators almost all died. So yeah, there were ways to save people, but the knee jerk, let's put them on a ventilator. And again, I don't want to sound like some crazy conspiracy theorist, but I'm going to tell you that based on the science and the dollars, there was an incentive to put people on ventilators because hospitals got more money when they did that. There were incentives to place people on they died of COVID list because they got more money for that. We do not know all the truth about how money drove what happened. We do know that the pharmaceutical companies were spending massive dollars to advertise, you got to get the vax, you got to get the vax. And that the media was following along saying that because they followed the money that was being pumped into their system. So I think it's unfair to Phil. I think it's unfair to his family for folks to tell us that they know what happened in those circumstances when I don't think there's been a full scientific inquiry of what actually happened and what other preconditions may have precipitated his being more vulnerable to COVID than people who have survived with nary scratch who also didn't get the vax.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Steve, thank you for coming on with us. We're at the end here, to come on and say such nice things about what was a competitor, but also a colleague and a friend. That's a wonderful experience for me to be able to moderate that and get it into the history book, so to speak. So, normally I said,
I'd be calling him all sorts of names. But since we were never actually competing in the same day part, it's easy to tell the truth about Phil.
That's even better. Okay. Well, tell everyone where they can go to follow you more and get onto your socials.
Yeah. On Twitter, it's The Gill Report, at The Gill Report. And I'm on different radio stations around the country, mighty990.com in Memphis. I'm on in London in the mornings on Great Britain News or on BBC about once a week. And I'm on Moscow on their morning shows on RT, Russia Today, about once a week as well. So you never know where I'll turn up.
Never know. You're an expert in all things. All right. Well, thanks again for coming on with us. And just out of curiosity, if Phil knocked on the door and walked in your office right this second, what would you say to him?
Brother, they said you were dead.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
Yes, man, it would be a thrill, but I wouldn't put it past him.
Greatest hoax of all time. All right. Thank you. We'll have you on again sometime soon. Thank you.
Thanks.
Harvey Durham Health Insurance Agency is the trusted independent health insurance agency that you can depend on for all your health insurance coverage needs. He's great because he doesn't look at health insurance as sales. He looks at it as helping people and doing the best he can to solve your current long-term care, disability, and Medicare supplement needs, even pets. I know, I'm a client, and so is my lab, Caroline. Over 30 years of insurance experience behind every policy. Give Harvey a call at 731-727-9242 or email him at harveydurham@harveydurham.com and tell him Steve and Steve at Mill Creek View sent you.
Hey, Phil Valentine here with some cabin sense. Governor Lee in Tennessee, who I think is doing a fantastic job, ordered a stay-at-home order as opposed to a strong suggestion. And I think he's getting some bad advice. This is not criticism of Governor Lee. I think he's been doing a great job. But at the same time, he's listening to folks who are telling him that there's an uptick and people traveling on the roads, according to the Department of Transportation. I think people are stir crazy. I think people have cabin fever. They're trying to get out. Where is there to congregate? There's nowhere to go. I mean, you can't go to a restaurant. You can't go to a bar. A lot of the parks, you can go to the parks, but you can't play basketball. You can't play soccer and things like this. I think you should be concentrating on where people are congregating. So where are people congregating? At the grocery store. And so we've got people that are bringing their entire families to the grocery store. Stop doing that. Susan and I, we take turns going to the grocery store. She goes most of the time. Sometimes she sends me, but we go alone. We go to the grocery store. We get what we need. We don't hoard. We can't find paper towels, so we don't get any paper towels. But we don't clear out the meat aisle either. So if you're going to go to the grocery store, send one person from the family to go to the grocery store and do it once a week like you normally would. There's another thing with the grocery stores, too. In San Francisco, they're now banning these reusable grocery bags that people are so big on to save the planet. I've long railed against these things because of germs. And so now they're saying, yeah, you're bringing germs back in. You could be bringing the coronavirus back into the grocery store. But I got an email from one of our listeners who says that a local grocery store here is telling them they're going to do away with plastic bags. He said, you're going to paper? They said, no, you're going to have to bring your own bag. Why are we doing this? We got to use common sense through all of this, folks. So here's the common sense. You can go outside, even according to the new order from Governor Lee. You can go out, you can kayak, you can canoe, you can do all sorts of stuff outside, but just don't congregate. You know, they've got that slogan they've got, do your part, stay apart. Come on, folks. This is Music City, USA. We got some of the top tunesmiths in the entire world. We can't come up with a better slogan than that. So as a matter of fact, if you'll leave your suggestions here on the comments page, we'll see if we can get some of those to the governor's office and come up with a better slogan. In the meantime, just don't congregate. Where's Johnny Cochran when we need him?
If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
We'll see you on the radio.
I got one, Steve. It's called Leave a Fart and They'll Stay Apart.
Ah, ba-dum-bum, okay.
Hey, I'm a songsmith. What can I say? I am a songsmith.
Way to step on a moment there. Okay, welcome to the Steve and Steve segment of our show where we cover what we just heard. Producer Steve, what'd you think of our tribute to Phil Valentine?
Well, I appreciate everything that the guest Steve had to say about Phil, and I never got to listen to him because I never lived in Nashville, and we had our favorites up here in the Seattle area. I know you and I are in the background thinking about putting together a tribute show for someone of our heroes here in the radio world. Hey, I'm a writer. I like to produce. I like to do podcasting. I've done my own little music things. I've done all that. And I'm like, okay, there's a future maybe for me, the producer, having my own show and working my way up. So, but Steve, it's neat that you're doing the same thing here. You're bringing in not only politics, you're bringing in individuals that are well-rounded, that are dealing with different things. You're bringing in some music. You're bringing in authors. And I think that's what I like about any good show is it's not just politics only. I can turn that off, turn it back on the next week. It's going to be the same thing. I want to hear variety, and that's what you need to be focused on. We're doing here, and what it sounded like Mr. Valentine did the same thing.
That's right. And you know how I painstakingly scour books and biographies to compile the list of quotes of the day I read at the end of each show, which kind of seems probably like I threw them on there, but no, I actually go digging for them. I'm looking for words to live by some of the most eloquent, thoughtful people to ever live with something to tell us that we can use in life, right? A lot of politicians, statesmen, deep thinkers, U.S. senators, even Obama and Kennedy, Josh Hawley, Tom Cotton. Anyway, here's a new senator that actually chairs a committee. Clip number one.
They have, it's in a guaranteed way to be saved by how, you know. So it's you know, isn't it appropriate that this kind of control should be more stricter? Or should we just go on and start bailing and sailing whoever bank, regardless of how their conduct is? Shouldn't you have a working requirement after we sail your bank with billions of your bank? Because they seem to be more preoccupied than SNAP and requirements for works for hungry people, but not about protecting the tax papers, you know, that will bail no matter whatever does about a bank to crash it.
I know people that are like that. They're very nervous, even though they're very intelligent. I'm not saying that off for my
Oh, no, guy. That's not nervous. That's sad. That there are two senators per state. That's one of the Pennsylvania ones, large state in America. That's John Fetterman. That is not okay.
No.
Okay. FBI releases 2002 statistics on law enforcement officers killed in the line of duty. According to statistics reported the FBI on March 1st, 2023, 118 law enforcement officers were killed in the line of duty incidents in 2022. Of these, 60 officers died as a result of felonious acts and 58 officers died in accidents. 60 officers were feloniously killed in 2022, a decrease of 17.8% when compared to the 73 officers who were killed as a result of criminal acts in 2021. That's good. The 60 felonious deaths occurred in 28 states and the District of Columbia. The 5- and 10-year comparison show an increase of 3 felonious deaths when compared with the 2018 figure, 57 officers, and an increase of 33 deaths when compared with 2013 data, 27 officers. Wow. Officer profiles. The average age of the officer who was feloniously killed was 39 years old. The victim officers have served in law enforcement for an average of 7 years at the time of the fatal incidents. Circumstances encountered by victim's officer upon arrival at scene of incident. Of the 60 officers feloniously killed, 6 officers were killed in unprovoked attacks. 12 officers died as a result of investigative enforcement activities. 12 officers were ambushed, entrapment, or premeditation. 4 officers encountered, assisted an emotionally disturbed person. 4 officers were involved in pursuits. 6 officers responded to disorders and disturbances. 6 officers were involved in tactical situations. 1 officer was involved in arrest situation. 3 officers responded to crimes in progress. 3 officers were assisting other law enforcement officers. 2 were serving, attempting to serve a court order, eviction notice, subpoena, etc. 1 officer was providing deployment equipment, flares, traffic cones, etc. Weapons. Offenders used firearms to kill 49 of the 60 victim officers. Three officers were killed with vehicles used as weapons. Eight officers were killed by the offender's use of personal weapons, hands, fists, feet, etc. The suspects, law enforcement agencies identified 51 alleged assailants in connection with the felonious line of duty deaths. 10 of the assailants had prior criminal arrests. Two of the offenders were under judicial supervision at the time of the felonious incidents. Next story. Most COVID-19 deaths may be the result of a completely different infection. Health Magazine, May 11th, 2023, by David Neild. COVID-19 is no longer classed as a global health emergency by the World Health Organization, but scientists are still working hard to understand more about the virus and its impact, including how the coronavirus affects the body and leads to death. A new analysis suggests that a high percentage of people who required help from a ventilator due to a COVID-19 infection also developed secondary bacterial pneumonia. This pneumonia was responsible for a higher mortality rate than COVID-19 infection. The team looked at records for 585 people admitted to the intensive care unit, ICU, at Northwestern Memorial Hospital, also in Illinois. They all had severe pneumonia and/or respiratory failure, and 190 had COVID-19. Okay, 585 out of 119. The findings refute the idea that a cytokine storm followed COVID-19, an overwhelming inflammation response causing organ failure, was responsible for a significant number of deaths. There was no evidence of multi-organ failure in the patient study. Instead, COVID-19 patients were more likely to develop ventilator-associated pneumonia, VAP, and for longer periods. Cases where VAP didn't respond to treatment were significant in terms of the overall mortality rate in the study. The relatively long length of stay among patients with COVID-19 is primarily due to prolonged respiratory failure, placing them at higher risk of VAP. Thank you, Darth. All right, keep that in mind for the end of the show. Next story, NEA president, the largest teachers union, three times Randy Weingarten's AFT, we needed to follow the science on COVID school closures. On Tuesday's broadcast of MSNBC's Morning Joe, National Education Association President Becky Pringle responded to a question on whether schools stayed closed too long by stating that we needed to follow the science. Clip number two.
Well, Susan, there are so many lessons. First of all, we had the light shining on the inequities in this country, not only in the education system, but in the healthcare system, in the housing system, in the economic system. We saw on full display those inequities that impacted our Black and Brown and Indigenous communities the most, our students with disabilities, our students living in poverty. We saw that they didn't have the tools they needed as we went to virtual learning, but that's always been true. That was not new. Just people were realizing that reality. So as we continue to try to recover from the pandemic, we cannot take that light on off of those inequities. And we've got to invest in our public schools, invest in our communities, invest in our students.
So, Becky, as we're talking about the pandemic here, Dr. Anthony Fauci a couple weeks ago gave an interview where he conceded that there are, the word he used was deleterious effects of the schools being closed so long. And he sort of said, I'm not the one who closed the schools. I just gave my medical opinion the best I could. So with the benefit of some hindsight now, do you believe the schools were closed too long? Now that we know that young people tolerate COVID relatively well, or at least better than some, and that the schools, in fact, were some of the safest places in communities, should they have been open sooner?
You know, Willie, one of the things that I did in working with schools and educators and parents and community members all over this country, I said that as we go through a pandemic that no one understood or knew about or knew how to get through, that we needed to follow the science. As a science teacher, that's where I start. We need to listen to the disease experts, infectious disease experts, and then we needed to come together to figure out what was best for our students. I actually visited a school in Western Pennsylvania with First Lady Dr. Jill Biden, who is still teaching and an NEA member, and that school was open in the spring of 2020, and the reason they were able to open one is because they did all of that, those things that I said. In as we look back on what we just decided to do, and as we look forward to what we need to do, one thing is true, and that is that we have to accept our shared responsibility for the learning of our students. That's why we are focused on community schools, so they can get the health care and they can get the dentistry they need. They can get the mental health supports, which is a huge issue in our schools. We can make the schools the hub of a community in a powerful way, and we can close not just the academic gaps, Willie, but we have social and emotional gaps that our students are coming to us every day with, and we need to share that responsibility to give them what they need and what they deserve.
She is really good about coming around and repeating her same thing, that they want more money, they want to do a better job of doing schools. Never mind, she kind of avoided everything. But interesting enough, and I'm going to let you move on here, Steve, did you hear that? Spring of 2020, Jill Biden's school was open.
Didn't answer the question, though, did she?
No, not at all.
Did you keep them closed too long? Never said no. All the buzzwords, though. And she said, First Lady Dr. Jill Biden. Doctor of what? Do you know?
No, I do not. Is that proctology?
Education. In October 2020, Pringles, the woman you just heard, said that she had seen no instances where local unions had gone too far in their conditions for reopening schools. And in February 2021, said that we're asking for the federal government to provide the resources we need so we can reopen our schools, not only safely, but equitably. She also, I don't even know what that means. If the door is open, everyone can come on in. She also argued in February 2021 that students were being asked to go back to school without getting the proper resources in place. Randy Weingarten blasted by Twitter again over deleting tweets. She also turned off her comments. What is she afraid of? Me, probably. Okay, the article by Ian Miller. Powerful teachers union head Randy Weingarten has not been having the best time of it on Twitter recently. Weingarten has become a frequent target of the platform's community notes feature thanks to repeatedly sharing misinformation. One of the more incredible examples was Weingarten's promotion of PolitiFact's politically motivated fact check, defending her role in helping keep schools closed. Our union is here for you to help you future-proof your social media. AFT Union has partnered with Life Brand for a 25% discount off the cost of this powerful tool that scans your social media to catch forgotten posts that may not reflect who you are today. Randy Weingarten. The exact cancel culture that our left-wing ideology weaponized to push people from things they said years or even decades ago. As one writer points out, this feature could be useful for teachers who openly campaign for progressive causes or took vacations while claiming to be too scared to return to classrooms. Randy Weingarten, who is openly supportive of such efforts, undoubtedly wants to make it easier to hide those kinds of comments from parents. She's emblematic of the left's repetitive MO, set the rules and ensure you never have to play by them. Classic Randy. Good article.
Your favorite woman, Steve.
She's not a woman, but okay. Take Pride Act. Next article. Take Pride Act forces nonprofits to abandon their values, attorney says. In effect, this means a boys' club that seeks to provide father figure type mentors to boys would be prohibited from allowing male-only mentors, attorney Renee Carlson explained by Haley Feeland, May 11, 2023. The Minnesota DFL's controversial Take Pride Act seeks to abolish existing state law allowing nonprofits that serve minors to uphold sex distinctions in hiring practices such as scouting and youth sports organizations. Renee Carlson, general counsel of True North Legal, called the legislation a significant encroachment on the fundamental liberties of Minnesotans who choose to live consistent with their personal moral values and religious beliefs. Under the guise of human rights, this legislation would shrink the scope of current exemptions under law, effectively banning disagreement over the government's perception of sexual orthodoxy, finding those who reasonably object to government's ideology in violation of the law, she told Alpha News. Carlson, who submitted a two-page letter to legislators outlining her concerns with the bill, said the Take Pride Act is not about equality. There's that word again. To the contrary, this bill strikes at the delicate balance and preservation afforded to individuals in a free-thinking society. chipping away the most basic fundamental rights guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution and the Minnesota State Constitution, she explained. Rather than protect fundamental liberties, this bill creates a slippery slope to continue repealing the law's existing protections for people of conscience, especially individuals who believe in sex-based biology, distinctions between males and females. As a nonprofit association that focuses and supports equity for all, we are in support of removing an employment exemption that would give youth-focused nonprofit organizations the ability to not hire someone based on their sexual orientation or gender ideology, added the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. I love how they're going after the law and the language to try to make sure that the parents don't get their children under their wings.
I know.
I don't really love it. That's sarcasm, but okay.
I know.
All right, next, moving along. Next article. Biden's DHS gives phones to border crossers while releasing them into the U.S. Huh, let's read about this. DHS provides some border crossers and illegal aliens with phones to track their whereabouts. Those given phones are enrolled in the Alternatives to Detention, ATD program, which allows new arrivals to remain in the United States without being detained while waiting for their cases to come up. From October 2021 to September 2022, Biden's DHS gave phones to more than a quarter of a million border crossers and illegal aliens as they were released into the United States interior. The phones cannot search the internet or make calls. The cost to taxpayers, their tracking devices, the cost to American taxpayers is more than $360,000 every day. All right. Next segment. I know. Taxpayer money at work. If this is false, it will end the Robert Kennedy Jr. campaign. If it's true, his popularity will increase across the political spectrum. It's worth 2 minutes to hear them. Clip number three.
They are not doing their job as regulators. And in fact, the senior scientist at CDC today, the senior vaccine safety scientist, who's been, in fact, he's still in fact at CDC, he was the senior scientist there for 18 years. He is the author or co-author on all of the major studies that CDC has produced on vaccine safety, and particularly the studies that show the vaccine does not cause autism. His name is Dr. William Thompson. 3 years ago, he came forward and he said, we have been ordered to fake all the science of the last decade on autism. And he said, in fact, we were in the major study, which is called the Stefano 2004, it's the most cited study on this subject on PubMed. And he said, in that study, we found out that Black boys who get the MMR vaccine had a 363% greater risk of getting an autism diagnosis than Black boys who waited after 36 months. Right. He said he was ordered to come into a conference room with all that data, with his four other co-authors, by their CDC boss, Frank DiStefano, who then ordered them to destroy that data in front of them in CDC headquarters, and then published that study saying there is no effect. So you have an agency that is really just an arm of industry, and the people who are in my community who are being derided and vilified, these mothers who have vaccine-injured children, are being vilified in the press, who are saying, wait a minute, we have read the studies, the scientific studies. We have read about the industry corruption. We need to talk about this. They're being silenced by the press. They're not allowed to tell their stories, and nobody is talking. Not a single member of Anderson Cooper's staff or Sanjay Gupta has made any effort to talk to Bill Thompson, and he has been begging to be subpoenaed, and he's still at CDC.
Yes.
Robert Kennedy Jr. on the CDC whistleblower who revealed the agency faked the science of autism. 3 years ago, he came forward and he said, we have been ordered to fake all the science for the last decade on autism. Holy shit. Do you know why he sounds like that?
No, I don't. I heard somebody say something and I'm not going to repeat it.
It's called spasmatic dysphonia, a specific form of an involuntary movement disorder called dystonia that affects only the voice box.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. Clip number four, please.
To let our state descend into some type of Faucian dystopia where people's livelihoods were destroyed and their rights were curtailed. No, in Florida, we chose freedom over Fauciism, and we were better off as a result of doing that. And I think it's important because your governor did it right. We had other Republican governors do it right. Don't let them rewrite history about the last 3 years. Fauciism was wrong. Fauciism was destructive to this country. And we can never let anything like that happen ever again in these United States.
Yeah, he early on, he went along like everybody else and promoted the vax and promoted the masks, but someone got a hold of him and said, dude, enough, and he did pull back. So I was grateful for that.
Yeah, yeah, and they chose freedom over Fauciism. I like that. Fauciism. Next, yeah. It looks like illegal immigration isn't super popular with Black residents in Chicago. Seriously, this is the response to 250 to 500 illegal immigrants. Imagine dealing with the millions like our border states. As more are sent to cities, you'll see more anger. Clip number five.
Come to us, now you want to overly compensate right. for people who never lived here before, and they we need to be taken care of first and foremost before anything else happens here.
Why would any leader put our Black communities already riddled with crime at further risk by placing unvetted non-taxpayers steps away from our seniors? Our children and our homes we've worked so hard on our own to secure.
We are at war, people. Our communities are at war. They are violating our communities, and we asking that we have, we across the country, we asking and we're demanding for Office of Black America, or whatever you want to call it, to deal with issues like this.
That's right. I did get placed on a wait list, but I was told that the immigrants was taking priority. No. That's a story that a lot of people don't know, and it just, it hurt me. I'm like, oh, wait a minute. I understand we need to be humanitarian, but these people are, that my participants are third and fourth generation Chicagoan, born, bred, fed, and raised here. My grandmother, Mayrella Carrington, rest in peace, always said, Craig, charity starts at home first, and then it goes abroad.
Politically, having over 500 people in our community would completely wipe out any interest we have.
Many of these migrants have been dumped in our neighborhoods without a plan in place to monitor and house them long term.
I'm not selling nothing, and I keep telling people, you don't have to move. If you sell, they're going to come in. If we don't sell, we got to stand strong and go.
I like that. Born, bred, and fed. Some of these guys got, they just, man, it rolls off their tongue. I need to be faster on that kind of thing, Steve.
Yeah, you do. California launches new snitch hotline to report hate acts and hate incidents, including name calling. California has launched a new hotline for residents to report hate acts. Last Thursday, Governor Gavin Newsom, D, and the California Civil Rights Department announced the launch of California vs. Hate. Through the hotline, Californians will be able to snitch on their neighbors for committing hate acts, which the service explicitly states do not always include violence. A hate incident is a hostile expression or action that may be motivated by bias against another person's actual or perceived identity, the website states. Perpetrators may be motivated by different discriminatory biases, including, but not limited to, bias based on race, color, disability, religion, national origin, sexual orientation, or gender, including gender identity. Some examples of hate incidents, according to the website, are refusing service, derogatory name-calling, and bullying. The new hotline, Newsom explained, is an equivocal message that hate will not be tolerated in California. Sorry, an unequivocal. Unequivocal. Ugh. The state will, the state firm for a California for all, and it's important that we hold perpetrators accountable for their actions and provide resources for those individuals victimized by hate crimes, he said in a statement. Now, Californians have another tool to ensure that not only justice is served, but that individuals have access to additional resources to help deal with the lingering wounds that remain after such a horrendous crime occurs. He's the tool. Remember the Stasi, secret police in East Germany?
Oh, yes.
That's what that is. All right, next article.
Talk about wounds. Talk about wounds, Steve. What about all those trans people who have inoperable wounds now that they've changed over? They will never, ever be able to come back.
Yeah, they should call that hotline. You're right. Lingering wounds that remain after such a horrendous crime occurs. Segregation Returns to Campus by Madeline Kearns, August 25th, 2020. It is neither anti-racist nor progress to house students based on race. Before the Supreme Court ruled in 1954, Brown versus Board of Education decision that racial segregation in public schools was unconstitutional, the lower district court in Kansas conceded that such policies were detrimental to minority children since they contributed to a sense of inferiority. In subsequent years, legislative milestones such as the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1968 Fair Housing Act provided practical and symbolic relief from such degradation. Or, that has long been the consensus view anyway. For decades, some have fought to reframe segregation as a progressive cause, and in recent years, their anti-racism has found fertile ground on campus. Last year, the National Association of Scholars, NAS, published an investigation, Separate But Equal, again, Neo-Segregation in American Higher Education. The report authors studied 173 public and private schools pulling from all 50 states. They found that 43% of the schools had residential segregation, 46% had segregated orientation programs, and 72% had segregated graduation ceremonies. Black students should not be forced to do the labor of explaining cultural touchstones like hair rituals and advocating for their humanity within their own homes. There is not one space on campus entirely dedicated to Black student life. Black Lives Matter cannot be reduced to a slogan sent in university-wide emails. Now is the time for NYU to create tangible change to support its Black students. We are hoping that Black living communities can spark a new effort toward comprehensive Black inclusion across NYU. What do you think, Steve? Are we going backwards or forwards?
Can you get enough of this stuff? I think it's no. All money. Follow the money. Follow the greenback. Get back. Follow my greenback. That's what they're doing there.
Okay, I didn't know you were a rapper. Liberal media circles the wagons around Biden's corruption. Clip number 6. Let's end this.
I had my SRS 10 years ago.
It's been almost 4 years since I had the first stage of my vaginoplasty.
I had my second SRS revision surgery.
I am getting a second surgery.
After my surgery, I was just in such a dark place that I didn't really want to talk about it. I didn't really want to have to go back into it and feel all those feelings over again.
I had a few complications, bleedings, infections.
I've had complications and I've had a hard time.
I did have some complications and I did have some, you know, concerns that not everybody deals with.
I thought it would make me happier. And initially it did. Was that worth the constant issues I've had? The dilation I have to do for the rest of my life?
I'm having the worst time with dilation.
I was experiencing a little bit of dehiscence, which is basically when you are so swollen that the sutures that they put start to rip open. It was as bad as it sounds.
I had trouble urinating. I kind of walked around with it for a year before I seeked help.
The reason I'm dilating twice a day is because if I miss once, it is so painful. I like dread it so much because it's so painful.
I went to dilate again that night and I think that I moved a stitch. I don't know what happened, but something happened and I was in excruciating pain. It felt like literally somebody had like shot me or stabbed me or burned me or something down there.
I had to dilate and I had to try to open my urethra up and it was just like, yeah, I'm going to start crying.
I was bleeding every time. I literally...
Steve, I can't take much more of this. This is just making me want to cry.
Well, it was wrong clip, but hey, the doctors performing these surgeries with the state of the technology being what it is are so unbelievably cruel. So I wanted people to know that, but I didn't want them to know it today. Sorry. Stay tuned for my thought of the week. With Columbia, Tennessee-based EnergizeHealth.com, you lose fat fast, simply, and naturally without restrictive exercise or cardboard, dry, tasteless food. Revolutionize your health with this proprietary 88-day science from John and Chelsea Jubilee. People report getting off medications and reversing ailments. Energy, mental clarity, and alertness go through the roof, look and feel many years younger and oftentimes unrecognizable. I know, I'm an alumnus and lost 70 pounds of fat with John and Chelsea and wouldn't have energy to do 3 shows a week without it. Hit the link in show notes for your free consultation and discount, money back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose but unhealthy fat. EnergizedHealth.com.
Hey guys, this is Riley Gaines, a recent graduate from the University of Kentucky, where I was a part of the swim team. I'm a 5-time SEC champion, 12-time NCAA All-American, and you're watching the Mill Creek View Tennessee podcast.
Very funny, very funny. Welcome to my quote for the day. But before I share, I want to remind everyone to subscribe to Mill Creek View Podcast. Just go to Rumble or Spotify or iTunes and hit the subscribe button and follow us. And thanks for doing it. You are in recovery if you say you are. Phil Valentine. The further I get into recovery, the less I know. Phil Valentine. I'm just using common sense. What are my odds of getting COVID? They're pretty low. What are my odds of dying from COVID if I do get it? Probably way less than 1%, he said. I'm doing what everyone should do, and that's my own personal health risk assessment. If you have underlying health issues, you probably need to get the vaccine. If you're not a high risk of dying from COVID, then you're probably safer not getting it. Valentine, who once said that he wasn't going to get the vaccine because his chance of dying were way less than 1%, is now hooked up to a ventilator at night and an oxygen mask in the day to help him breathe. All of a sudden, he got weaker and weaker and felt worse and worse. And I think it was Friday, a week ago, they x-rayed him and said that he had COVID-related pneumonia in his right lung, Mark Valentine said. His situation deteriorated incredibly, and it scared everybody to death. He was very close to not making it. Life Science Magazine, April 2020, nearly 9 in 10 COVID-19 patients who are put on a ventilator die, New York hospital data suggests. Around 88% of patients with COVID-19 who are put on a ventilator in a New York hospital system died, according to a new study. In the new study, researchers analyzed data from 5,700 patients who were hospitalized from March 1 to April 7 through Northwell Health, the largest health system in New York, with 12 hospitals across New York City, Long Island, and Westchester County. Of those patients, 2,634 were discharged or had died by the end of the study, and 320 patients with a recorded outcome were put on ventilators. Nearly 9 in 10 of those ventilated patients died. What really killed COVID-19 patients? It wasn't a cytokine storm, suggests study by Northwestern University, May 4, 2023. Investigators found nearly half of patients with COVID-19 developed a secondary ventilator-associated bacterial pneumonia. Those who were cured and their secondary pneumonia were likely to live, while those whose pneumonia did not resolve were more likely to die, Singer said. Our data suggested that the mortality related to the virus itself is relatively low, but other things that happened during the ICU stay, like secondary bacterial pneumonia, offset that. What I celebrate is that he has chosen to use his trauma to be transformational. His voice will be very loud to folks who've been polarized, Walker said. And for those who love him and respect him, it is an opportunity now. I'm praying for him. Bishop Joseph Walker III, spiritual leader of Mount Zion Baptist Church, home to Nashville's largest Black congregation. About Phil Valentine. That's it for this episode. Really hoped you liked it. Rest in peace, Phil Valentine. Thank you. Until next time, this is your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of millcreekview.us, mcview.us. Let's go out with a tip of the spear by Phil Valentine and the Heartthrobs for podcaster listeners only. Peace in our time.
Long time ago, the torch of hope was lighted. They wagered their lives on the flame. But look at us now. Dreams been soiled and blighted. just who to blame. How does it feel when you know we're watching? How does it feel when you live in fear? The weapon of words may not be too frightening, but we're just the tip of the spear.
County Fair. They were looking for America behind every turn, flying the very colors that so many love to burn. I'll cruise the countryside with my dad and my brother, row after row of cotton and corn, moving through this place just like rolling thunder.
Any views or opinions represented on the podcast are personal and belong solely to the creator and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the creator may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity unless explicitly stated.